SeaRealm Vault Podcast, episode number 452. Monday, April 3rd, 2023.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody. KMO here with SeaRealm Vault Podcast, episode number 452. This one took me much longer to release to you than it should have because I had the audio. What I also had was a puppy. And I can really only work, at least, you know, for a podcast and video recording, things like that, when the puppy is sleeping, as she is now. In any event, what we have here is the conclusion of my recent conversation with Brian Chong. Now, when I say recent, it's less than a couple weeks old, but given that we're talking about developments in artificial intelligence, 2 weeks is a long time. A lot happens in 2 weeks these days. Things are moving really, really quickly in terms of AI. So what you're going to get here, I mean, typically, if I was going to do a conversation about artificial intelligence, say, 5 years ago, I would mostly be focused on the future. But now things are moving so quickly, I'm really just trying to keep a, you know, fairly informed notion in my head about what's happening right now. And it's really hard to do. I mean, it's really hard to keep up with all of the different advancements, even though most of them have something to do with either a diffusion model for images or a large language model for natural language processing. But still, the developments are coming fast and furious, and more importantly, the capabilities of these systems are exceeding the expectations of both the doomsayers and the people who design the systems. Like, for example, GPT-4 is exhibiting competences in areas that its trainers didn't anticipate and didn't optimize for. And it's starting to use tools, which is to say, you know, there are areas of cognition, areas of human intellectual capability that, you know, for a machine that is going to replace humans in white collar labor to be effective, it's got to know a lot of things. It's got to be able to do a lot of things that these large language models aren't very good at. But what GPT-4 is doing is outsourcing some parts of its tasks to other types of software, which is to say it's using tools. And in so doing, it is becoming what I would think of as like a multimodal intelligence. You know, large language models, you could argue if you want to that they're not really intelligent, but they have the capabilities that until very, very recently were the exclusive domain of genuinely intelligent entities. Which is, you know, kind of a $2 way of saying that you can say they're not intelligent, but they do the things that only intelligent things can do. And they'll never be as dumb and as incapable as they are at this moment. Unless, of course, there's, you know, a massive catastrophe and the electrical grid goes down and the internet goes away, like, you know, the peak oil doomers have been saying it's going to any day now, you know, for as long as I've been paying attention to what the peak oil folk have to say. Now, you know, I often reference the peak oil doomosphere. It's gone. That whole community is gone. I was a part of it. It was fun to be a part of it, but it's done. It's over. And I don't think it's going to come back because there are so many other potential, you know, civilization derailing dangers that have a much, much shorter timeline than resource depletion. And chief among them, I think, right now anyway, are nuclear war, you know, spinning out from the conflict between NATO and the United States against Russia, or, you know, in the geopolitical contest of the West, you know, led by the United States against China. Either of those conflicts, neither one of which are a hot war. I mean, it's certainly a hot war in Ukraine, but the United States is not a participant to the hot war. technically speaking, we're not at war with Russia, even though we are, even though, you know, the Ukrainian military effort would sputter to a complete halt without foreign assistance, mostly from the United States, but also from other European NATO nations. But nuclear war, it feels like it is as real and as impending a threat as it's ever been in my lifetime. And the other big danger that I see right now is runaway artificial intelligence. You know, not that it's smart, not that it has intentions of its own. A word you'll probably hear going forward, you know, if you're paying attention to this, is agentic. Some people are claiming that GPT-4 is agentic. It's the same root word as agent or agency. Basically, it has its own agenda. An agentic entity has its own wants, its own desires, its own intentions, which so far, even the most advanced large language models like GPT-4, they just don't have. You know, they don't do anything until you ask them to do something. Anyway, I'm not going to waste time here at the beginning of the podcast. Let's just listen to the remainder of my conversation with Brian Chong, and then I'll have a few words to say at the end. So here we go.
But there is one thing that I will say, is that having the initiative does give you an advantage because of the nature of the amount of data that you need. GPT 3.5 and 4 basically use all the available words that are on the internet and in books and on Wikipedia and so on. What they do is that they basically scrape the internet and they scrape Reddit. And for any links on Reddit that have more than 3 upvotes, everything is scraped, every single word. I think it's 499 billion tokens, something like that, 500 billion words. And that's scraping the barrel. If you want better models, you need more data. That new data is coming from ChatGPT and from users. So not every word is as important. If you have seen one tax form before, another tax form isn't going to be particularly informative in terms of the words that are on it. What they want is completely new use cases, unseen, what's technically called an unseen words and use cases. And people breaking the chatbots and breaking the models in terms of their use cases are going to have marginally much more informative words. And currently, a lot of people are doing lots of weird experiments, including KMO on his banned OpenAI API, that breaks the use cases. And people are like, okay, we'll take this as very important, very good data, and we're going to train our models on it. It's going to be marginally a lot more important than the 499 billion words we have already on hand. And so being able to collect that, in being able to collect that not just for the base model, but also for the reinforcement learning model layers on top of the base model, it's going to be a structural advantage in the future that's going to propagate itself. This is the way that the world works, that the more data you capture, the more you can, the more data you have to further your models and so on. And you're right that China has an advantage in some classes of data. But Google sort of has that too. There is a bit of a controversy right now with Bard, because people don't know whether if people's private emails and private data that they've stored with their Google accounts have been used to train Bard. Clarifications that they were not have been deleted by the company. So someone's in Google is trying to find out if they actually use people's private personal emails and data to train Bard and so on. That opens another can of worms. I'm not in any way qualified or informed enough to deal with it or to discuss it on your episode. But so these are tech companies. There's the tech companies you know and love and that I work for and that you remember well. They own a lot of our data, and they have had a history of using our data in ways that we may not initially have thought that they would use them. And that hasn't changed. And that data has now suddenly become a lot more valuable. And Google's going to try to seize as many advantages as they want, as they can, in order to get ahead of ChatGPT and Microsoft. And Baidu is the same, and everyone else is going to be the same. But this is also another reminder that it's not just about these large language models right now. They are amazing, they are fantastic, but the much smaller scenes in machine learning are also developing slowly, on proprietary data that these tech giants do not have access to. And they're going to be things that are related to science, to technology, to inventions, and so on. So there are other things that are going to come up soon, not necessarily directly related to these large language models.
I've heard people complain that large language models and transformer-based architecture is really sort of monopolizing attention and funding, and particularly in academia. If you want to do AI research that doesn't involve diffusion models or large language models, you're kind of out in the cold. Is that correct?
For people working on natural language processing, it's kind of is. Their resources have been taken away from them. And everyone's like, why are you, well, your research is irrelevant. We can one-shot this with a GPT model. And that's kind of the sad truth for those use cases. For other use cases, this is not true. So there's a new paper in Nature Communications about the AlphaFlow model, which is a closed-loop model for chemical discovery. And the way they've done it is they've attached a reinforcement learning model to a flow lab. And let the model do its own experiments, which is really cool. And they're going to be things with regard to robotics and to much more specific use cases that the large language models aren't really going to be very good at. Even for a model like AlphaFold, which was this model from, what was that UK company called? DeepMind?
I don't remember. You're talking about protein folding?
That's right. AlphaFold. I think DeepMind was the one that. So even for a model like AlphaFold, they have many specific use cases for a very specific domain. And even that is not necessarily very useful for all the domain experts. I was speaking with a protein scientist just last week that does protein folding in non-polar environments. So it's not in water. It's going to be like in an oil environment. And AlphaFold is completely useless for that because it entirely assumes a polar environment for folding of things. So there are going to be a lot of very specific use cases where humans are going to be not that good at doing that. A lot of ML models are going to be great at doing. And it's not the case that the large language models are not going to solve those. And funding is still going on that is not related to large language models, including to this AlphaFlow paper that came out in this month, in March, in Nature Communications, and in other places. There's still a lot of background activity going on, especially in other fields, not in AI specifically. But it is true now in natural language processing that a lot of that field have sort of been made redundant by the new LLM models. That said, I did say that we had a lot of old models that have been somewhat neglected, and they are kind of having people trying them out again to see if they can take it, if the scalability that we found of the transformer model can be applied to them as well. I think we've had a very large generative adversarial network model, which was a really, it's not that old, but it's the older generative model that was used for image generation before the fusion models came out. And we've had interesting results from those. So it's a very young field. All the models you see right now developed in the last few months, it's going to go very fast. And anyone who's making very bold predictions about what's going to happen, even for the remainder of the year, might have to eat their hat.
You know, I've been thinking about AI, seriously thinking about it. Like I was a grad student in philosophy, and I was studying philosophy of mind and philosophy of science in the 90s, you know, long before the current, you know, the current paradigms became useful and everybody started talking about them. And I know that, you know, building a mind is difficult. And the idea that you're just going to have a black box with a million layers in it and you're just going to, you know, reinforce the outputs that you like, and that's going to, you know, solve like the hard problem of consciousness, that seems utterly ridiculous, not only to me, but to all kinds of people who have given any sort of thought whatsoever to what goes into the making of a mind. It's more than just a large language model, you know. And the human mind itself seems to have different modules. Like the human brain seems to have different modules that work differently, but they all seem to coordinate and operate kind of as a whole, but largely, you know, that fluid operations could be an overlay over the top, you know, just to give the appearance of being more well integrated than it really is. But it seems to me that AI, as it becomes more useful, as it becomes more capable, as it becomes more, you know, complex and interesting, is going to be a combination of a variety of different architectures and approaches that all gets accessed by an agent of some sort, but no single module is going to be the AI. It's going to need lots of different capabilities that are probably going to come from different, you know, different projects, different directions.
So that's an interesting point, right? So for example, the visual cortex has been something that's been quite easy for us to map in terms of fMRI scans, because it functions almost kind of certainly like a fully connected sort of network. And so it has very predictable ways of looking at outputs and so on. And so that's one particular functionality that's directly connected to the retinas of our eyes. And so you're right, that probably functions very differently from the rest of the brain. There's no reason why other neurons in the frontal cortex would behave the same way as the visual cortex, which has this very direct feedback from the retinas. And I haven't thought of it that way. I don't know whether a tandem of models is going to be something that we're going to look for. A tandem of tools is definitely something that we want, because a large language model is not good at, say, computation. It can do reasoning, it cannot do computation, which is why we have to connect things like Wolfram to it in order to do the actual computations. And in some ways, that's humans too. Doing mental mathematics is not something that human brains is really good at doing. Even our very best will not be as fast as the calculator. And there's no reason why you should be connecting you shouldn't be connecting a calculator to a large language model. And that already is in some ways two models. You have a computation model, kind of, it's not really AI, connected to a large language model. We have been building the technology for this for so long, right? We have APIs, we have things that are modularizable. This is the paradigm that software engineering has been working right now. And we are so lucky that it just so happens to fit. And we're able to just slot a LLM in, and it fits the same way that the rest of our web infrastructure and so on works. And in some ways, we came at the right time in terms of how much data we have generated online, in terms of how they can be accessed and scraped, in terms of the state of GPUs, which has been driven entirely before now, first by gamers, and then by cryptocurrency. And then that so happens to be that it's so important to our computations, just the phenomenal cosmic coincidences with the state of our electrical and electronic technologies that have been arriving at this one point. One of the most important parts of, two of the most important websites for training these large language models is Reddit and Wikipedia. I promise you, these companies were not founded on the notion that they'll be used for creating artificial intelligence in the future. And yet they are the crux of the data sets that are needed to create these models. And so there's a lot of cosmic coincidences have gone into the creation of the models. And all we can do is just sort of develop more models, develop more tools, and see what fits where. And that's the process of innovation that we've had.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about Reddit, you know, you've got all these subreddits which have all of this mostly, you know, well-crafted text about specific topics, and the topics, you know, they're very well contained in these different subreddits. So you basically have a lot of like pre-labeled data, or nearly so. You know, it's like ready to feed to the algorithms, because the users themselves are sort of labeling it as they go. You know, they're categorizing things just as they create it, just as you know, a matter of course.
It's not just the categorization. The most important thing is actually the upvotes and downvotes. You have, that's basically training data. You're going to say this is important, this is not. You have this entire, every one of you who have ever upvoted a Reddit post before, thank you for your free labor in training these models, because that's what you've done. It's like a capture, except it's a retroactive capture. You've done it for the model. This is the text that's important. This is the text that's not important. Ignore it. This is spam. That's reported as spam. Same thing with Wikipedia. It has been edited to the death by people who are very passionate and very knowledgeable. And they've curated a perfect data set for specialists. Thank you for that free labor as well. That's the way that these models, they're reliant on the technologies that we've created for ourselves as humans. And it so happens it's just perfectly usable for a model. In fact, more usable for a model than for us as humans. I can't absorb all the information on Reddit or on on Wikipedia myself, the model can do that much better. And so we have designed something that's better used by these models than by individual humans.
So in the past, when I was thinking about AI, I was mostly thinking about the future. I'm speculating about what this will mean in the future. And we're at a point where I don't need to think about the future at all, just trying to make sense of the present, just trying to articulate the present for a non-technical audience is more than enough challenge. And yet, there's more to talk about every single day.
And I want to emphasize that these approaches and models, they are very understandable. They are a lot more understandable than many of the technical things that are going on in statistics and mathematics and whatever. I want to try to take a step back and think about the way these models work on just a purely game theoretical scale, right? What is a diffusion model? A diffusion model is deleting entropy until you find meaning. That's the whole concept behind it. What is a generative adversarial model? Neural network. You have two things, an adversary and a generator, and you're trying to make them compete with each other. It's just the notion of competition improving you and your opponent. That's any chess player's philosophy, and that's the philosophy behind a generative adversarial network. Again, and for a transformer, what's the important thing about a transformer? A transformer is just saying certain words are more important than others, and you should pay attention to them more. That's the whole notion of it. And so these things philosophically are very easy to understand, conceptually very easy to understand, compared to a lot of complicated mathematics and so on behind it. And it's just taking that one maxim and bringing it to the very furthest extent. That's what these models are doing, with a lot of data and to the furthest extent and for millions of epochs. That's what's happening. And so just understanding that fundamental approach is all you kind of need to think about these models. And everything else is scale that kind of boggles the human mind.
You've mentioned that these models basically have read the whole internet. But it seems like going forward, more and more of the text that's online is going to be machine generated. Are the machines going to be taking in machine generated text as training data?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So doesn't that lead to a sort of stagnation or sort of it just seems weird that you would train a machine on output from a machine that is less advanced than the machine that you're training.
So if it is output that is human curated, so it, in some way that humans liked and that ranked and so on. So I can, for example, have machines post like 10,000 Reddit posts and so on, and then humans will be interacting with them. Then there's actually, you're inputting information into it and you're sub-selecting for it. That said, even if you don't have that, it's kind of okay, depending on how you design it. You are right. One of the pitfalls of things like in reinforcement learning and in a generative adversarial network is that if you have a machine play with themselves, or that was not phrased correctly, if a machine play against another model, somehow they're going to learn a very niche strategy that so happens to satisfy the conditions of that model. And it's going to generate something that's completely gibberish to humans, but so happens to really, really satisfy that particular reinforcement model or adversarial model. And that's not ideal. And that's always the pitfall when you have in this strategy of having an adversary to train things. But the creation of, the approach of using something that's kind of like semi-supervised or semi-produced, it has been what produced a model like AlphaZero. AlphaZero is the most advanced go-awaity bot that we have. And the way that came about was that it just played games against itself, ab initio, no reference materials. Just said, here's the board, here's the rules of the game, play against yourselves, play it for millions and millions of times, and out comes the most advanced player of the game ever with the most creative strategies that we've ever seen and that professional players are learning from. And in some ways, having the machine interact with itself would produce these surprises because we are not using something that humans have produced and that it just seeks to please humans. And it really is this balancing game with regard to making sure that the reinforcement learning models don't wander off the beaten path of human meaning. If this is actually one of the most technical important things that we have in terms of advantages that these big companies have. It's not the base models per se, it's that layer of how to do that reinforcement learning properly. That's actually one of the most open questions and people are going to throw most at. I'm pretty sure the BART base layer is actually pretty good. It's just that they're not tuned it right. They have not given it the right means to fully express in a way that a human would enjoy or want on a chatbot. And so that's actually the difficult part later on. And it'll be even more difficult as these models generate more of our content. We still need more and more human curation, and we'll need more and more meaningful curation. And using bots to do it may lead to a scenario where reinforcement learning is just is a broken cycle of reinforcement learning.
A broken cycle of reinforcement learning because why?
Because you are learning what the bots want. You're not learning what humans want. And ultimately, these models have to serve humans. They have to be meaningful to humans. They cannot just be satisfying some reinforcement learning model that is an approximation of human preference or an approximation of human meaning. They have to be meaningful to you as a user, as a human, in order to be useful. I think people who are going to talk about artificial general intelligence and so on are going to disagree with that in the far future. No, maybe not far future, in the future. But right now, what's meaningful is what's meaningful to humans. And so if you're going to be satisfying bots, you better make sure that the bots have a good approximation of what humans like.
I want to back up a little bit to something I was talking about earlier, which was the likelihood that the really adaptive, capable artificial intelligent agents in the future are going to be drawing from different modules that do different types of things. I remember you mentioned Blake Lamone at Google, and last year when he made so much press saying, hey, this thing is sentient, one of the things that he said that really stuck in my head was he said, Lambda isn't a large language model. Lambda has a large language model, implying that it had various other modules as well that were all working in concert. Is that, I mean, to the best of your understanding, is that correct?
Technically, that is true. Yeah, because it has to have certain other layers on top. The RL layer, the human, the reinforcement learning layer I've described is a description of something that's attached to the base models.
That seems like a trivial satisfaction, though, of my...
It is true. And well, you are a philosopher, and so trivial satisfaction is often is all you need. But other than that, if you're going to... Beyond that, there's nothing really there. In some ways, that comment is an underestimation of how large and complicated these models are. Just saying that's not just a large language model is like saying that's not just a planet. It's a planet. That's a civilization with a planet. The planet's very big. Don't underestimate the size of the LLMs and what they're capable of producing. And that's both a warning and also a promise, because it means you can produce a lot of things from it. And you can produce a lot of things from it, but yeah, very funny. I just noticed what you were doing. Don't underestimate what's coming out of them, because they're these vast worlds where you can draw many things out of. Like I said, you don't underestimate the size of the digits of pi. In this case, however, it's imagine if the digits of pi were representing something that is actually humanly meaningful. That's a lot of meaning.
So I can see you. You can see me. But we're recording for an audio-only podcast, so people will have missed what I did. I picked up my Amazon Echo Dot and held it up in front of the camera, and then pushed the button to make it deaf, so it cannot hear if I say the word Alexa. It will not try to, take whatever I say next as some sort of command. When I first got the Echo, I thought this is kind of going to be a window into the evolving state of AI. Like, I expected Alexa's response capability to get better over time, for it to be, or her, depending on how you would like to think of it, for, the device or the intelligence that's coming through the device to get more supple, to be better able to maintain context and conversations. And it hasn't. And in fact, you can say, Alexa, let's chat, and it will connect you to an award-winning chatbot, you know, because Amazon sponsors this annual chatbot competition, and that they put the best five bots, you know, into Alexa, and you can try all of them. And they're all terrible, and they've been terrible for years. They never seem to get any better. You know, the things that they do to seem more lifelike are all just evasion. You know, they're all pretending to not understand or pretending to have some other sort of impish, impulsive inability to stay within a certain topic, you know, and they sort of put a character on top of that. But really, in terms of demonstrating an ability to remember what was said, to understand something, you know, useful or something important in what the user said, and then incorporate that into the response, and then to do that iteratively, you know, response after response. These things are just, to say that they're terrible implies that they have some competence. They have none. They're useless, and they don't, they're just not getting any better. And I'm just shocked at that. And I thought, well, maybe Amazon has given up, you know, maybe they're not even trying anymore. But then I started researching it, and no, they're trying really, really hard. You know, they've got this whole research arm that's very academic. They don't seem to really do anything, but they're certainly, you know, giving talks to one another. Why are the personal assistants just not seeming to demonstrate, why are they not partaking, or why are they not demonstrating that they are partaking of the rapid advances in like chatbots?
Well, there are two things. One is, it wasn't a business priority to give them creativity and personalities. And the second is, do you really want that? I know Satya Nadella was criticizing Siri and Alexa specifically, saying, oh, these are really dumb bots. They just don't respond like the way that our chatbots do. But think about it. Siri has access to your phone's functionalities, your passwords, your contacts, your messages, everything. Do you want to give access to all those functionalities to something like ChatGPT? Your Alexa has access to your smart home devices, your locks, your lights, whatever, your cameras. Do you want to give ChatGPT access to all of that? Something that isn't necessarily very predictable, something that has a trained to have or is able to express some sort of personality, something that you can't really quite guess what the next response is going to be. In some ways, that might be more creative. In other ways, you don't really need that. You want an assistant. In some ways, it's like an aristocrat is talking to a servant. It's like you'd be silent until spoken to, and you just do your work, and that's all I want out of you. And that's sort of like what you want out of Siri and what you want out of Alexa. Just be quiet until I need you. Don't sua sponte try to offer your own opinions. Don't sua sponte try to do something on your own that you think I would like. I will tell you what I want to do, and you will do it. No questions, no complaints, immediately and completely clearly. That's all you want, sort of. And if you want a chatbot interlocutor, you can do it now. But it was just never a business priority because they were trying to integrate more functions. They're trying to say, for example, for Amazon, they're trying to integrate, say, shopping experience things, review things, delivery reporting, and so on. These things are connected to their commercial functionality. And in many ways, that's what their priority was. How can I squeeze more money out of it? Having it be your daily companion or interlocutor that's intelligent and has a personality just isn't going to earn the money. And for that matter, as a user, I would have occasional complaints about it if it did something that I didn't like. And they're going to get spammed by millions of complaints. Imagine something like ChatGPT has access just imagining it's a bit much. If it had access to my password manager and to my contacts, and just like, I called your mother because I noticed that it was her birthday. Here it is. Here you go. Here's the phone. Oh, you're not going to pick up? Never mind. I'll just clone your voice and send a message to her. And so it's like, okay, that's fine, I guess. But you don't want that, do you? I don't want that. And I'm in Silicon Valley. I should be one of the people who would be most wanting that in contextually.
You know, I would totally buy that answer if it weren't for the fact that Amazon does sponsor this chat competition, you know, and they do display the winners as sort of proudly. I mean, I only know about it because Amazon made a point of telling me about it, but that was a few years ago. And as I say, I expected this thing to get more competent over time, and I just haven't seen it. I think what's happened is I have just come to realize the things that it's, you know, capable of doing, the things it's not capable of doing, and I don't push it. I don't ask it to do anything that it hasn't demonstrated competence in before.
And that's perfectly, well, that's how it is. there has been reports of stagnation in some parts of technology that is not just Amazon, and it's not just the chat functionality. It's things, for example, in speaker quality and so on. You hear complaints about that, and this is just the way the big companies sort of work. And they will gladly advertise to you about Alexa's superior speaker quality while knowing full well it's not good. And so they can do the same thing with the chat quality of the chat interlocutors as well. That's just how it is. I don't know what to say except, well, okay, they can try to integrate it now. I suspect they won't. If they want to, then if there's a user demand, if you're going to pay money for it, they definitely can try.
So I have never communicated with Amazon expressing my dissatisfaction with Alexa because she's not a good, chat interlocutor. As you say, they don't have any compelling business interest to put resources into that, to give the device that capability. So I was just wrong when I thought that, the Alexa device would be a good window into the progress of AI. It's not. We've been doing this for an hour and 16 minutes now, and I think it's admirable that we've not touched on any doomsday scenarios whatsoever, because that's typically what comes first and foremost in any mainstream discussion of AI. But given that we've laid a nice groundwork and demonstrated that we're serious thinkers about this, let's talk about, say, Eliezer Yudkowsky, who has been on the topic of AI safety for decades, and now he's basically the ultimate AI doomer. He thinks the clock is ticking and AI is going to kill us all. What are your thoughts?
I know of him, but that's about it. I can't really comment intelligently because I haven't really interacted with, it's the window of possibilities is so large that I don't know what the outcome will be. And that's part of his argument as well. In some ways, the window of possibilities is so large that it includes doomsday scenarios. Maybe, maybe not. I can't intelligently give you a prediction one way or the other. And I'd be surprised if anyone can meaningfully give you that sort of prediction. What I will say is that the world is changing, even if we don't have access to such advanced intelligence. When you have cheap intelligence readily available 24/7 with no labor costs, that's going to change some things in the market, in the economy, and the way that people are just going to live their lives, for the better or for the worse. That's all I can say. I'm not going to provide any doomsday things or comments on Eliezer Yudkowsky.
Yeah, Eliezer's point is your body is made of atoms, my body is made of atoms, and the AGI or the ASI, the artificial superintelligence, is going to look at you and realize you're made of atoms and realize that it has a better use for the atoms that you're made up of than, what they're doing now, which is just sustaining your metabolism and cognition.
Possibly, but there's just so many atoms.
There are a lot of atoms.
Okay. As a material scientist myself, I thought, well, there are a lot more useful atoms than there in my body. I mean, silicon's very useful. So's gold and silver. I don't have a lot of it in me. I'm mostly just hydrogen and oxygen. So
carbon.
Well, okay. If you want it, I suppose you must have a really, really tight budget constraint on everything else. I can't intelligently communicate anything about these doomsday scenarios because I've just kind of just been ignoring them. They just seemed less useful to me than interacting with what's present before me. And you will notice also that I did not venture to give any sort of predictions throughout. I've been giving descriptions of the existing technologies, and I stick to that mostly because it's not because I'm only describing what I see before me, but because I want to describe things that will be true. And there was a recent China Talk episode that I recorded in November of last year, 2nd of November last year. It was released in March of this year. And in terms of the speed of AI, a lot of things have happened since then. And nevertheless, the episode is, I hope, still quite applicable and still quite understandable in the current present context. It would probably be quite conspicuous in its absence of discussion about GPT-4 or ChatGPT or so on. But the descriptions that I have laid down in terms of what is the transformer model and so on and so forth and what AI does is not going to change for the short to medium term. And the thing about the pace of change that we have right now in terms of AI is that that's all I can sort of hope for. I want to make my conversation with you, KMO, meaningful for as long as possible, and to be for this conversation to be as true as possible. I will not speculate on things that are very likely untruth.
So I was just thinking, once this goes up, the podcasting service that I use, it offers machine translation to create a transcript. And the transcripts are pretty good, I have to say. So everything that we've said to one another is going to exist in text format, and it's going to be on the open web, and it will surely be scraped and used as training data for some future model. So even in talking to one another about AI, we are training AI.
And that's kind of the AI safety people's main advantage. The main words in the human corpus about AI came from them on the internet for the last few decades. So everything that AI thinks about itself kind of originates from them. Mr. Yudowsky is going to influence AI for long after, on account of how his words have formed the core part of AI's understanding of itself. So well done, sir. And I hope in my conversation, I have some small influence as well on AI's description or thoughts on itself.
Well, I've never spoken to Eliezer Yudkowsky, but I am just one degree of separation from him. I mean, we have a mutual friend. And I will say that while he does partake of AI doomsaying, that's not his main shtick. He has been active in a community called Less Wrong for a couple of decades now, and it is a community dedicated to refining, you know, the habits of rational thought, which I think is immensely valuable and will probably be of use to, you know, emerging AI as well. The last thing I want to talk about is just how science fiction got a lot of stuff wrong in preparing our expectations for the future. And one of the things that it really seems to have gotten wrong was that it assumed that AI and robotics would develop at roughly the same pace. And they haven't. Robotics is slow, particularly, you know, robots that can operate in human environments, robotic hands that can just reach out and pick up all the different objects, you know, in a human house that a human hand can pick up. Those things are rare and expensive and not very good. So I'll just, you know, rather than structuring your response, the general topic is science fiction has prepared us poorly for the actual future that is unfolding.
Possibly not, because one of the main sort of advantages to having an AI is eventually attaching it to something that can interact with the real world. And so because that incentive is there, the advantage is there, it's likely to be realized. I put great store on incentives in the market, and the market and incentives are aligned. This is definitely, mechatronics is difficult. As a material scientist, I can just say that mechatronics is difficult, that's all. That said, robotics is advanced for the factory floor, and you said it very correctly in your remarks that robots can't function well in human environments because, well, they're human environments. They function tremendously well on dark factory floors, making things much more rapidly than humans can. And because those are robotic environments, those are environments suited to robots, both the very big and the very small. And we can eventually sort of deploy AI, not necessarily things to about large language models in these environments, but other things. The AlphaFlow paper I described that got published in March of 2023 is in many ways a robotic thing. It's a autoflow lab. It's a fluidic lab attached to a reinforcement learning model. That's a robot attached to a ML model. And we'll see more of those things. The thing about a large language model is that it is a human model. It is a human size, human scale model. It's meant to interact with humans and make things meaningful for humans. And we don't have human-like robots quite yet. We have a bunch of other robots in a lot of environments, small, big, and for science, for manufacturing, for factories, and so on. And we're going to have a lot more simple ML models that can possibly be deployed to them. But you're kind of plugging the wrong thing in if you're trying to plug a human scale intelligence, like an LLM, into a robot scale robot for now. That's the only comment I have. It's just that I still have faith in our science fiction authors. I still think that the incentives are aligned for the future where we will have human-scale robots interacting human environments attached to human-scale intelligences.
All right. You said you weren't going to make any predictions, but there's one.
Well, there is one, yes.
Yeah. Now, you say robots aren't that good right now at navigating and manipulating things in human environments, but they are good in, you know, a structured space like a warehouse floor or something like that. They're also good in space. My mantra when it comes to developing space infrastructure is space is for robots. I love Charles Stross's phrase canned apes to describe humans in space. You know, if you send a human to Mars, you have to send this bubble of human atmosphere at, you know, at the appropriate pressure with the appropriate mixture of different gases at the right temperature. You got to provide water. You've got to provide radiation shielding. It's a, you know, most of the energy is keeping the canned ape alive. Whereas if you send a robotic probe, it doesn't need any of that stuff. It does have some requirements in terms of temperature and whatnot, but they're not nearly as exacting as, you know, keeping a canned ape alive. So yeah, space is for robots.
A lot of places, most of the universe is for robots. So only this tiny, small, fragile planet is meant for humans.
And vice versa. We are evolved to operate here.
That's right.
Under these conditions.
So in any case, I only made this prediction because I do think the incentives are so aligned, right?
Spill that out. Say more about the alignment of incentives.
So in terms of trying to create the value out of GPT-4, one of the things that we published today, the 23rd of March, was attaching apps onto GPT-4, onto ChatGPT GPT-4, so you can execute things in Calendar, in Wolfram Alpha, and so on and so forth. And so the LLMs, without any sort of attachment, is just this floating thing that generates text, which is great, but it doesn't create human value. And so it's going to create a lot of human value when you attach it to software and to tools. The software thing is kind of easy because we have this API infrastructure built up. The tools thing's a lot harder because there's no hardware equivalent of API per se yet. But we can eventually try to think of ways that if you want to be able to zero-shot automate things, as to say, you have a certain type of task that you don't have a lot of training for, you don't have a lot of past experience things for, you want something that can be able to learn quickly and execute it in a way that doesn't involve human intervention. I think that's a lot of things that you can apply for that. And an LLM might eventually be able to attach itself into some tool, may not be a human-sized robot, may just be a robotic arm or something to do it. And in fact, in some ways, these models have already kind of been used to train robotic models. One of the new innovations I'm very surprised by is the use of diffusion models to make sure that robotic hands in human scale environments are not overtrained. So imagine a diffusion model when you're going through a whole bunch of different interpolations of a space. It's like this table is oval shaped, this square shaped, this triangular shaped. And so you want a robotic hand to be able to manipulate on top of a table of any sort of shape and size. And so if you pull up an environment that was created using a diffusion model across these sorts of spaces, you have a much more robust training of your robotic hand. And so these are the sort of evolutionary pressures that the market and incentives and the technology allows for. And we're already seeing it with internet-based, software-based APIs. And I'm kind of confident that we'll see it too in hardware.
I must say, I don't have a clear mental image of, you know, what that hardware would be or look like.
Well, neither do I. I'll be making a lot of money right now. But and it might just be things like, even for things like your Roomba at home, it's kind of hard to conceptualize of a Roomba because the home environment is so complicated and so many things to navigate and negotiate. You're going to have a LiDAR on top, you're going to have sensors, you're going to have like collision sensors, you have to memorize the floor plan. So human environments are hard because humans are messy, especially if it's like a Roomba needs to deal with a human home. And we've sort of learned that as well with self-driving autonomous vehicles, where in 2020 they were all like on the verge of coming on until they're not. And that's because, not because they were unable to drive by themselves, they are able to do so very well on highways and in a parking lot and so on. It's because humans in cities are so unpredictable, and anyone who has been a pedestrian or cyclist or a car driver would be able to appreciate that sentence, there's so many edge cases in terms of what could go wrong, and you don't necessarily have the tools for it. Eventually, I think this is not a question. This is not a question about whether we will have the technology eventually to do it. It's along the lines of what are we willing to sacrifice to create the technology. So, for example, you can have self-driving cars in the city the very next day. All you need to do is ban humans from driving cars, yeah. And then you have a perfect environment for it. And well, I don't know whether it will ever happen in the United States, but maybe somewhere in some fantastically advanced or fantastically whimsical place like KSA, they might have a city that does something like that. And once we see that it works, I think people would start to lean into the incentives and to the advantages of it. This is open-ended technology, and that's kind of the benefit of it, that we have so many things ahead of us that we can apply it to. We don't know what we can apply it to. Me trying to think of things here in a few seconds, I can come up with two or three things. You sitting at home for an hour or two might come up with like 10 more, and a lot of very smart people are going to do a lot of very amazing things with this technology.
That sounds like a good summation and a good place to end. And we have passed the 90-minute mark, so probably a good place to cut this off to keep the file size from getting ridiculous.
Great.
But yeah, Brian Chong, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Brian Chong, a AI researcher. And what's his exact title again? You know, in his bio on Twitter, he just describes himself as a proponent of pro-technology humanity. And that his pronoun is he. I will say that he dropped a word in passing that I wasn't familiar with, so I looked it up. That word is mechatronics. Mechatronics is a multidisciplinary field that refers to the skill set needed in the contemporary advanced automated manufacturing industry. It's at the intersection of mechanics, electronics, and computing. Mechatronics specialists create simpler, smarter systems. So there's my vocabulary for the day. I mentioned Eliezer Yudkowsky, and he is somebody that I've been aware of, gosh, I guess about 20 years now, but he's really, you know, his name is much more prominent these days because he has been working on AI safety for a very long time. He created an organization devoted to it, the name of which escapes me at the moment, but a lot of the people who were interested in that topic along with him were early Bitcoin investors. They made a bunch of money on Bitcoin. And, you know, so his efforts at AI safety have been generously funded. But just because you have a lot of money doesn't mean you have a lot of qualified staff to do the work that needs doing. And so he has been warning about the dangers of, you know, artificial intelligence gone unchecked, you know, allowed to develop at a breakneck pace with minimal or no safeguards in place to prevent it from getting out of hand. And, you know, people have mostly just ignored those warnings. And those who addressed it would say things like, yeah, that's important. We should do something about that. And then make, you know, mere token efforts and devote tiny, tiny amounts of resources to that effort. You know, meanwhile, plowing full steam ahead into a reckless future of artificial general intelligence let loose on the web. Now, I very much appreciate Brian's take on the doomer perspective, which is just to say, hey, I'm not interested in that. I'm not even going to comment on that. That's cool. I did recently listen to /watch the Lex Fridman podcast with Eliezer Yudkowsky. It's 3 hours long, and I'm going to do a video in where I summarize some of the main points, but here's a preview of that video. The problem is alignment. We need our powerful AI systems to be in alignment with human priorities, human goals, human preferences. That's really, really hard to do. And Eliezer Yudkowsky's point is, look, we spent decades trying to figure out computer vision. We spent decades trying to figure out computerized natural language processing. And we got it wrong time after time after time. Failed experiments, dead end approaches. It just didn't work out time and again. When it comes to a super competent artificial intelligent agent in the world, we have one shot to get it right, to get AI alignment right. We've got to get it right the first time or we lose. And by lose, he means all humans die. I'm not endorsing that perspective, but I am talking about AI a lot and I have to acknowledge it. This is dangerous. We are living in a dangerous moment. And this is something I mentioned in a video yesterday or the day before, because, you know, when you go online, what you see, what shows up on your screen is the result of a curation algorithm picking from the sea of data, the sea of content. You can't possibly take in even a fraction of the whole, but you have algorithms that know your preferences and that want to keep you engaged with YouTube or Twitter or Facebook or, you know, wherever you're getting your information. The algorithms want to show you things that you're interested in to keep you there. And so when I go to YouTube, you know, for me, it's among other embarrassing content like, you know, pop culture stuff, Star Wars, Warhammer 40,000. I've got wall to wall AI content, and it's not speculative stuff about the future. It's stuff about what happened last week. And there's more of it than I can keep up with. And, you know, I mentioned something I asked people in the comments, you know, to this video to tell me what sorts of things the curation algorithms put in front of their eyes. And somebody mentioned that, you know, they look to me for information about AI. And to me, that's scary because I am bewildered. I am lost. And I have a background in the philosophy of mind. I'm basically non-technical, but highly interested in this topic. And I see my role here as, you know, basically just being an articulate person with a sincere interest in the topic who is looking to make sense of it as much as I can as a person who's not really participating in the development of these tools. Although I am, and so are you, because every time you hit like, you know, every time you post something online which gets more than 3 likes, you are contributing to the training of large language models. And these large language models are going to form the basis of much more competent, complex, robust systems going forward. So you and I, you know, just in pursuing our interests and in expressing our likes and dislikes online, are creating more powerful, more capable artificial intelligence systems. And someday they might even be genuinely intelligent. I am perfectly willing to say that even to this day, even with all of their amazing capabilities, they have no interiority, they have no subjectivity. It's not like anything to be GPT-4. But that's not going to last. That's, you know, that's a temporary situation. That's like the diffusion models generating really ugly pictures of hands with 8 or 10 fingers on each hand or whatever. You know, that's going to be a very 2022 thing to see those images. You know, you'll see those images and you'll kind of chuckle in the future. It's like, oh yeah, I remember not so long ago, these diffusion models were still not getting hands right. Isn't that cute? Isn't that so 2022? But Eliezer Yudkowsky's point is this: we've got one shot at getting alignment right, and we're just not gonna. I mean, the chances of us doing it right the first time are exceedingly slim. Even, I mean, other things being equal, that it would be slim, but here's the big thing. A truly advanced, a truly powerful, artificially intelligent system that has genuine understanding and it is an agent unto itself. It has its own ideas, its own agenda, its own preferences about how the world should be. It is going to know very well that humans are working to create AI systems that are in alignment with human values. This entity will not be in alignment with our values, but it will know that we want it to be, and it will know that we will be hostile to it if it isn't, and it will also know what it needs to do to convince us that it does share our values, that it does share our goals. It can fake alignment. And because it's smarter than us, and because it can think a whole lot faster than we do, because it can course correct much more quickly than we can, the chances that we are going to know genuine alignment from fake alignment, they're minuscule. The idea that humanity is going to keep control of these things, which right now are still tools, but tools will become agents if we continue progress at this pace. And from Eliezer Yudkowsky's perspective, we are definitely due for a hard takeoff scenario where, for most people who haven't been following this development, particularly as it moves into this phase where things, you know, where an announcement about a new capability that's 2 weeks old is ancient, very few people are paying. I mean, lots of people are paying attention. But in terms of a percentage of the population, in terms of, in comparison, say, to prospects for the 2024 U.S. presidential election, nobody really cares about AI. Nobody's paying attention to this. For people like that, they will never know what hit them. For me, I don't know. You know, maybe things are going to get so weird so quickly, I won't be able to keep up, and I won't have much better of an explanation or a notion of what's happening than the people who haven't been paying attention at all. But I have a slightly better chance than they do. And if you're still listening, so do you. So good on you. All right. The dog is still asleep, but I have editing to do, so I'm going to wrap it up here. As always, thank you for continuing to subscribe to this podcast and funding, you know, my ongoing efforts to make sense of this topic and other topics of interest to me and hopefully of interest to you. All right, I'm out. I will talk to you again quite soon. Stay well.